Okay, so now we can move on to the next stage, which is the Q&A. So we'll see if the questions are any good and see what's going on here. Anything interesting here? Let's see what happens. Okay. So here we go. Dear Venerable Ajahn Brahmali, I read in a Dhamma book that Venerable Ajahn Shah had said that people mistake the objects in the mind to be the mind itself. Could you kindly talk about this, please? Thank you. Okay, so the idea here is that the awareness or the consciousness is one thing, and the things that we observe in meditation is something else. And so there is a distinction between the two, and it's possible to abandon the vast majority of the objects you have in mind and still be aware. And this is in large part what the process of meditation is all about, right? As you are, you're sitting inside of yourself, first of all you let go of the external things, you let go of the five senses, and after you let go of the five senses, the mind is still there, the mind is still doing things, you're still feeling things, perceiving things, you're still thinking thoughts sometimes, and after a while you start to realize that those things also can die away. The thinking dies away, the various perceptions you have die away, and the mind gets simpler and simpler and simpler, until eventually all you have left is just like almost like awareness itself, and everything else has faded away. Right? So there is the mind is complicated. Mind objects is one thing, and the consciousness which is aware of these things is something else. Or they're interrelated, but they're not completely, they don't coalesce into one thing. They can be separated out from each other. And this is, I think, what he... probably what he is very hard to know exactly what he meant, of course. You can only make a guesstimate of these things. That is what I think he probably was talking about. And in the path of meditation, then about simplifying the mind more and more and more. And as you enter samadhi, eventually the mind is very, very simple, right? That's why it's called ekagata. It's one-pointed on one thing. It's completely satisfied in the present moment. There's no movement in the mind anymore. There's no distraction there. And then after that, you continue to simplify things more and more and more, until you reach states that are so kind of out of this world, so completely, you know, whoa, what is going on? So you keep on that track until eventually pretty much everything disappears. There's almost nothing left whatsoever. So something like that, I think, is what he was talking about. It means you don't attach to the contents of the mind, but you allow them gradually to fade away. Okay. So what does the Buddha have to say about energy, i.e. good or bad kinds, work environments, creating sanctuary conducive to practice, etc., etc.? Okay, so what does the Buddha have to say about energy? So it here depends on what you mean by energy. Here you are talking about some kind of external thing, probably. You're talking about the work environment. You're talking about the kind of the feeling around you, right? What does the work environment feel like? This is one kind of energy. Another kind of energy is the internal energy inside of yourself. These are two separate types of energy. And the most important type of energy is actually the personal energy that you arouse in meditation practice. And you will find that when the mind starts to become peaceful and calm, mindfulness starts to arise, you start to become joyful and happy, then energy comes as well. You feel energetic inside of you. One of the things, you know, Ajahn Brahm says, and this is really, really nice, because his meditation is very, very profound, and he says you become like a nuclear reactor, right? Because you have so much energy. It's like a nuclear reactor inside of you. You're bursting with energy. But it's a peaceful energy. It's not a kind of restless thing. Very energetic, but very peaceful at the same time. It almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, because for the vast majority of people, energy means restlessness, right? Energy means running around. But this is the peaceful kind of energy, where you are aware, you are joyful, you are happy, and you're still so much, mind is so powerful and so bright. And this is the most important thing, because if you have this kind of energy, the external environment doesn't really matter so much. You are independent. You have a large degree of freedom from the influence of external things, if you like. But for a lot of people, they haven't got there. You haven't yet built up that internal nuclear reactor, right? It takes a while to get that nuclear reactor going. So until you get to that point, as you say, it is important to have the right environment, because certain environments are more destructive to your energy, to your sense of well-being and to your own energy and all these kind of things. So it is important to actually have a good environment. That is certainly true. So if you have a great work environment with, you know, good workmates and, you know, feeling good about work, that is wonderful and that is important. But remember that sometimes it is not so much about the environment itself. That is only one thing. You know, you can change jobs and you can turn and it go somewhere else and you find the environment is still the same, right? Very often the most important thing for whether work environment works or not, if the work environment works, right? So if it is a good work environment, the most important thing is your own attitude. If you have the right attitude to your colleagues, to the people around you, to your boss, to everybody else, then the work environment tends to become a good one. So actually that is also the most important thing here. The attitude is what matters. And even if you have a bad environment around you, if your attitude is right, it's not going to drag you down all that much. Because how you look at other people is so important. This is something I will talk more about on this retreat, how to deal with other people. This is one of the most challenging things in life, right? Other people affect us so much. There's a very important lesson in that. When you remember, recall how much other people affect you, affect your happiness, your well-being, your ability to be content and satisfied. When you recall that, you also know straight away how much you affect other people. And that is a very powerful incentive and motivation to be kind in life. Because if you see how other people impact on you, wow, you can actually do so much for other people just by saying the right thing, doing the right act, thinking the right thought, right? It's this energy, this vibe coming off you. Even if you think the wrong thought, something isn't quite right. So you have an incredible power inside of you to make life more livable to people around you, just like other people have an ability to impact on you. So this is a very important lesson, right? We tend to focus on ourselves, think, oh, how does the world impact on me? But remember, there's a lesson to be learned there about you and how you affect others as well. And when we use these things in the right way, it becomes powerful. Having a spiritual, creating a sanctuary that is conducive to practice is great. And many people I know, they have at home, sometimes they have a room that is dedicated to meditation practice. And if it is a nice room with a nice environment, right? And after a while, you kind of build up a certain energy in that room. The energy arises because you've been doing your meditation there for a long time. When you come into the room, it's almost as if the room emanates a sense of peace. And it's very nice. It's like, you know, sometimes you come over to Bodhinyana Monastery, just go into the hall. And sometimes just going in there, there's a feeling of peace in there. It feels good. And the reason is because, you know, people have been meditating in there for a long time. I remember some years ago we had a builder, Adam Brown told me this story, I wasn't there at the time. We had one of these kind of concrete layers who was pouring some concrete for us, right? A kind of rough job, kind of big, burly fellow, you know, doing this kind of really quite rough manual work. And he came into our hall. For some reason he was asking to have a look at our main hall. And he said, wow, this is really nice energy in here, right? So it doesn't really matter. These things affect you. And this is what's going on there. So please create a good environment. It actually matters a lot. But the main thing is really your own attitude. So I hope that helps. If you want to follow up on these questions, please do so, because I may not get exactly what you are after. So it's perfectly okay to follow up later on. Okay. I saw a segment about the health benefits of mindfulness-based meditation on Catalyst. Okay, that's probably a TV program, I assume. I don't watch TV, so I don't really know what's going on in that realm. But I was happy to see meditation discussed on fairly mainstream TV show. There you go. But somehow I felt they missed the point. Meditation was just another self-help tool we can use to fix ourselves up, get what we want. The richness and depth of the Buddha's teaching was totally lost. Any thoughts about this sort of meditation? Thanks. Yes, I think that is a point very well taken, that the vast majority of reasons why people meditate in the world is to enrich their own life, to make their life better. And it's okay, right? It's fine. If people want to do that, no problem. You can take the Buddhist ideas of meditation and use them. If it improves your life, great. Personally, I think as Buddhists, we should be happy if anybody, you know, is able to use these teachings in a way to increase their happiness. Wonderful. But let's also be aware, as you say here, that actually there is a lot more depth to Buddhism than the vast majority of people who practice meditation are aware. Right? The vast majority of people, they want to have their meditation, but they also want to have their ordinary pleasures, right? They want kind of meditation sometimes to boost the ordinary pleasures. Because if you have more mindfulness, you experience the ordinary pleasures more. So it's kind of a help to improve the ordinary pleasures in life. But the problem is that, of course, the real depth of Buddhist meditations, it requires, if you want to take it a long way, it requires a certain degree of renouncing the ordinary pleasures, because there is a conflict. In the end, there is a conflict between the ordinary pleasures of life and the deep pleasures of meditation practice. You can't have both at the same time. Why is that? And it's very simple, because the ordinary pleasures of life, they take you out into the world. Right? You are attached to your senses. You're attached to the pleasures that come through the senses. Whereas meditation is the exact opposite. It is about giving up the senses, going inside of you. Now, if you are attached to the senses because you get a lot of pleasure through them, you won't be able to let go of them when you start, when meditation practice comes around. Right? You will be able to let go a little bit. You will experience some peace, but you won't be able to reach the real depths of meditation practice. And that is because these two things are diametrically opposed to each other. One thing is going out into the world, enjoying the worldly phenomena. Another thing is to withdraw from that world, going inside of yourself and experiencing something different, something far superior to the pleasures of the world. And this is, in a sense, what people are missing out on, right? They're missing out. They think that they can have both. They can't have both. And because you can't have both, you're actually missing out on that profundity, the real profundity of Buddhist meditation practice. And this is what we're seeing early on today. You're talking about sensual pleasures being described as low by the Buddha, hina. Hina means low or inferior. And that is precisely for that reason. There's something greater that can be achieved, right? This is, in a sense, one of those wonderful things that I always reflect on when I see somebody who is a really good meditator, see somebody living in the jungle somewhere for years on end, somebody going on retreat, staying in their hut for 6 months, like Ajahn Brahm, who didn't speak to anybody for 6 months. And then you come out the other end and you say, wow, 6 months of bliss. And these kind of stories, when you see these things happen. You see people living so simply with almost nothing in their life, and yet the enjoyment they have is far, far greater than the enjoyment of ordinary people in the world. There's something powerful and wonderful about that. It gives you this feeling of a greater reality, right? Something beyond the ordinary human experience. Something far more beautiful, far more powerful. To me, it is so it's so wonderful when you hear these stories, because it lifts you up. It gives you a sense of faith and confidence that there's something in this world really worth aspiring for, which is beyond the ordinary human experience. Isn't that great? Isn't that uplifting? And this is part of the kind of the Sanghanusati, the Dhammanusati, recollection of the Sangha, recollection of the Dhamma, to understand this broader context of things. And of course, people who aren't willing to give up the lower pleasures, they won't be able to get to the higher happiness. And this is really the problem here. This is what they're missing out on. Still, if they want to use meditation to boost their life, have a better life, please, of course they should do that. And what you find is that very often, this can be the first step towards a deepening of your understanding of meditation and spiritual qualities. So often it's the first step, right? You start doing a bit of mindfulness meditation, and that kind of takes you in a new direction. Your curiosity makes you read about things. Maybe you get interested in the Buddhist teachings. I know a lot of people who started off with more mainstream meditation practices, and then eventually, gradually, kind of, you know, came into the more a deeper understanding of Buddhism, and eventually even became monastics. It's quite a common way for things to happen. Okay, so I hope that was helpful. So let's have a look at the next one. Okay. Who or what is the we who is ignorant at the start of the change? His ignorance precedes the arising of consciousness and existence. Are you sure that it precedes the arising of consciousness and existence? It may seem like that, but that's not really the point of that sequence. It's not that it precedes it. It's just that it conditions it, right? So I don't think I said that it precedes it in precisely those terms. The idea is just that if you have ignorance, that leads to a certain way of acting because you think you can control certain things in the world, and that colors your consciousness. But the consciousness already exists. It's not that it arises at that point. It's just that your consciousness gets colored at that point. It gets a certain flavor to it, a certain level to it. But it's already existing. And you're quite right. Of course, there can be no ignorance. There can be no delusion. There can be no misunderstanding without consciousness. Consciousness has to be part of that. Otherwise, there is no misunderstanding. In fact, all of these things, one of the suttas I'm going to read out later on, all of these things, if you try to trace them back into the past, remember one of the things that the Buddha is supposed to have done is to remember his past lives. And he said that if you trace these things back into the past, he says no first point can ever really be found. You can go back and back and back. No first point where ignorance began, where consciousness began, where existence began, where craving began. All of these things have no first point to them. It always just goes back and back and back. And I think that's a powerful way of looking at the world. It kind of, to me, it makes eminent sense. There should be no first point. Why should there be a first point to these things? Then you'd have to describe how they came into being. And of course, the way they came into being is just because of their own conditions before that. So that's why you can take it back and back and back. Okay, so we move on to the next one. Okay, dear Ajahn, please tell us how to change some of our tendencies that were quite ingrained, especially negativity. Thank you. Okay, so how can we change our tendencies that are ingrained, especially negativity? Well, this is a very important question. This is, I think, one of the most important things on the path of meditation, is to learn how to change our habits and the way we normally relate to the world. This is so important. If we don't do that, we tend to get stuck where we are, where we're at. So very important to learn how to change our perceptions, to see the world in a new way. This really matters a lot. And the way to do that is to try to, first of all, figure out what does the negativity relate to. What are you negative about, right? Sometimes it will be about people. Very often, maybe the people around you, you see them in a certain way. Maybe you're seeing yourself in a certain way. And a lot of the Buddhist practice is about learning to see people in a different way. Right? And one of the most powerful things for me has always been to understand that people are the way they are because they have been conditioned this way. Right? People don't want to do bad things. You know, you see people doing bad things on TV or wherever, or maybe in daily life, or people say the wrong things to you. Why did they do that? very often we take it personally and we get negative about the things because the world is unfair, people are unreasonable to me, right? All of these kind of things. But remember that people are just the way they are because that is how they have been conditioned. They are the first victims of their own negativity. You may be a victim, but they are actually much more a victim of that stupid thing they're doing than you will ever be or ever can be. So they are the first victim, right? So remember that. They are just playing out the conditioning from the past. They probably don't want to be this way. They know that it hurts to do bad things, right? And because they know it hurts and they can't really help themselves, it means that they are a victim of their conditioning. Once you start to understand that, and you start to see the other person as a victim, rather than just thinking about yourself, I am the victim, right? I am being kind of badly treated by these people. No, the other person is the real victim. Instead of focusing on yourself, focus on the other person. And then it is so easy to forgive these kind of things. It actually isn't that hard. Once you think about the other people in the right way, they are the way they are because the way they have been conditioned. No problem. Fine. You know, it doesn't matter anymore. And this is, I think, a very important thing. It is usually with people that the biggest problems arise. And there is a sutta we will have a look at later on where the Buddha says that if somebody does a lot of bad things by body speech and by mind, you should regard them as a sick person, as an ill person, somebody who is suffering a lot, somebody who is going towards their own death perhaps because they have no doctor, they have nobody to help them. Right? They are a sick person. How do you feel about sick people? Do you tell them off for being sick? Not really, right? It's really unfair. Somebody is sick and you were to go and tell them off for being sick. You fool. You put yourself in a wrong situation. You idiot. I refuse to have anything to help you out. Usually if somebody is sick, you feel a sense of compassion, right? You feel, you know, it's not their fault that they came into those circumstances or whatever, whereby they got that virus or whatever it is. You have a sense of compassion towards them. In the same way, somebody who does a lot of bad things, you should regard them as a sick person. It is compassion is the right attitude to have in that situation. Why? Because they are creating so much suffering for themselves and they don't understand that they're doing that. We all want to create happiness for ourselves. They are making a massive mistake in creating enormous amount of suffering for themselves in this life, in future lives, and down the line, wherever it is. So this is some of the ways of overcoming that negativity. So this is one way. One of the ways also that I like to do is to count your blessings right in life. Count all the good things in life. Most of us, we have so many good things in our life, and we often tend to perhaps focus on the negative things. Actually, there's so much good things going on. Here you are on this retreat, right? With good friends around you, with people who are kind-hearted and good and generous. I know many of you. And I know that you're great people. What a wonderful thing it is to be part of this kind of retreat, right? This is one blessing. You're part of the Buddha Society of Western Australia, another wonderful organization with all these fabulous teachings available. There are people around the world in the thousands, in the tens of thousands, who are lining up to listening to the teachings of the BSWA in Perth, right? Here you are, in the middle of it. Wow, isn't that great? Now, even if you come from overseas, some of you have come from overseas, which is wonderful, you know, you have access to this place. There are so many things going right in your life already. Wow, what a wonderful thing that is. And when you see, when you count your blessings, you feel more positive about things. You don't feel so negative. There's so many things going right. Another thing to do is to remember what your practice has given you already. It is very easy to think in terms of all the things that you still have to do. Oh, I still have a bit of anger. I'm still getting upset about things. I still have all these desires going on. Oh no, I have so far to go, right? This is kind of the usual way that we tend to think. We look at what needs to be done next. But instead of doing that, look back on your life. See what has happened over the last 6 months, over the last year, over the last 5 years, and see how you have changed. Right? I love to do this kind of thing. Sometimes I think about myself, the way I was when I started out in monastic life 20 years ago. And I think, gee, I, you know, that was that would have it's wonderful to see the change that has happened over those 20 years. It is astonishing when I think about that change. And it gives me encouragement. When I look at all the things I still have to do, then, you know, I feel a bit, like, easy to feel depressed. But no, instead, I look at all the things that have happened. And what a wonderful thing it is that so many, that a change has happened. And you can do the same thing. So look at the change, look at where you're going, and that also gives you encouragement to practice, continue the practice. So it's all about how we use our minds, right? Use your mind in the right way, you feel positive, you feel encouraged, and the motivation is there to continue. Okay, so how you go with that. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, could you kindly explain what volitional formations mean, right? Okay, thank you. That's a good question, because I was working a little bit with Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhu Bodhi is the translator of a large number of the suttas into English, and I worked with him on the Anguttara Nikaya, and I said to him, we have to change this translation, it's terrible. I refuse to be part of a project which is going to use this translation. So I said to him, we have to do something about this. And to my surprise, he actually came around and he changed it. I think probably what happens, he had heard the same thing from many other people, right? And when you hear things from many different people, eventually you say, okay, we'll make a change. So I agree with you. It is a really a translation which doesn't really grab you. When you read it, it stops you in your tracks. And you think, what is going on here? What is this volitional formations business? And this should not be how a translation should be. When you read the suttas, it should flow along. The language shouldn't stop you so that you don't know what's going on. Language should kind of disappear into the background, and the message should go to your heart, right? This is the purpose. When the Buddha, imagine the Buddha teaching you. The Buddha would sit there, teach you, and it would be the whole purpose. What he's doing is to transfer that message to you. It would have to be immediately understood. When it's an oral teaching, either you understand it straight away or you don't get the message. So it would have been simple language, language that ordinary people can understand. You don't have to be a professor in philosophy to understand what's going on. Bhikkhu Bodhi is a philosopher, right? He has a doctor degree in philosophy. I think that's part of the problem. His language level is up here. Most ordinary people, we're kind of down here, right? So we're struggling a little bit. Sometimes when you read Bhikkhu Bodhi's writings, you have to have your dictionary there and you have to have his writings here and look up the word. You know, one of the things I remember reading in his footnotes in his Sanyutta Nikaya, he talks about synchronic and diachronic conditionality. And I thought to myself, what on earth is this? Right? And these are the kind of words that would really, they really kind of stand out for being completely incomprehensible to the vast majority of people. And the same thing is with volitional formations. What it means, sankhara. Sankhara just means the word itself is derived from the Pali word karoti. Karoti means to act or to do. And sang, the prefix sang is like putting things together. So it really means like putting things together, creating things, right? Doing, that's really what it comes down to. It is all the activity, all the actions inside of us, the mind, the speech, the bodily actions, all of those things. But it derived from the mind. It all ultimately stems from the mind. The mind is what drives all the actions everywhere. So this is what sankhara is, the creative activity that happens and is driven from the mind. So volition here, right? The word volition in English really just means the will. Formations, the idea here is that you are forming something, right? It's just another way of saying creating or constructing something. Yeah? So it's the will which leads to the creation of things, the creative activities of the mind. That's really what it means. So now thank you for saying that, because it just reinforces my hunch that sometimes the translations are too unreadable. And it has very unfortunate consequences. It makes us to distance from the Buddha's teachings. I think the way the Buddha taught people was in very simple and plain language. Ajahn Sujato, who many of you may know, he is now actually translating the suttas again into English. And he is trying to use a much more plain language than Bhikkhu Bodhi was using. So hopefully those suttas will be wonderful and beautiful when they come out. Anasudato has a very, very skilled with language and very is a very clever fellow. So hopefully it should be good when it comes out. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmani, can you please explain necessary and sufficient conditions again? I didn't quite grasp it. Thank you. It was really inspiring the way you talked about the first sutta today on volition. Okay, great. Second, the last, I am listening to you talk about this sutta. Important. Okay, okay. Important is just as good. So impact is just as good. Okay, great. That's good. Because sometimes that's the thing, right? You hear something twice, and every time you say something, you say it slightly differently. So every time the impact will be slightly different. So it's good that you can hear the same thing and not just get bored and start to yawn. That's wonderful. But you actually feel the impact every time. This is what I feel as well. I can read the same sutta again and again and again. And every time I read it, it has impact. And every time the impact is slightly different, right? You're seeing a slightly different angle to it. And this way you're expanding your view of the Buddha's teachings and getting a more profound understanding of what's going on. So the idea of necessary and sufficient conditions is really, it's actually quite simple. The idea is just that when one thing exists, then something else must follow as a consequence. That's the sufficient condition, right? If there is ignorance, you have to have not volitional formations, but you have to have these activities, right? These activities arise, the creative activities arise in the mind as a consequence of ignorance, understanding. Once you have ignorance, the other thing must follow as a consequence. That is the idea of sufficient conditionality here. And when you have the these creative activities of the mind, or the will of the mind, if you like, you can just call it the will if you want. When the will is there, that creates a certain level of consciousness. It must happen as a consequence. I will explain in more detail later on what exactly is happening there. It's quite interesting, actually, and it shows you, once you understand that, you understand how careful you have to be with how you act and how you think, so you don't drag yourself down, but instead you lift yourself up in this life. That is the idea of sufficiency, and all the way through, all the way to the very end, the last factor being dukkha, being suffering, every factor is enough to create the subsequent one. So once you have ignorance at the beginning, you have to have suffering as a consequence at the end. One thing leading to the next one thing being sufficient for the next one to follow. Right? And then there is the opposite, the idea that each condition is necessary for the one which comes afterwards, right? So ignorance is necessary for the will to have this will to exert itself. So because it is necessary, if you take away ignorance, the will has to stop, right? Because ignorance is required for the will to activate. You take away ignorance, the will must also end. This is what we mean by necessary conditions. So you take away the will, you take away the ignorance, the will must stop. Take away the will, then consciousness must come to an end. Take away the consciousness, nama-rupa, name and form must come to an end, etc., etc. All the way until eventually you arrive at suffering itself. So one thing ceasing must lead to the subsequent ceasing here. It's just really a fancy way of talking about conditionality. It sounds kind of fancy, right? Sufficient and necessary conditionality. I learned it from Ajahn Brahm, actually. Usually Ajahn Brahm uses very simple language, but sometimes he gets into these more philosophical things, especially perhaps at the monastery. But he's the one who kind of got me onto this idea of sufficient and necessary conditions. So if you don't like it, then you can blame him. But the principle is actually quite simple, right? If you think about it in the right way here. Okay, so if you're still having problems with that, you get free to ask again tomorrow if you like. Okay. Dear Ajahn, so I better put on these glasses. Is the mind within the body or is the body within the mind? Okay. Now that is an interesting question, isn't it? It is a bit philosophical though, so this is kind of veering slightly into the territory of philosophy here. Now I think from a Buddhist point of view, it is far better to understand the body as within the mind than the mind within the body. The mind within the body is like a materialist outlook on the world, right? The body is here, the mind is kind of stuck in here somewhere, and the body is here. But the Buddhist point of view, and this comes out very nicely in certain suttas, where the Buddha talks about the nature of reality, and the Buddha actually says the world, right, not just the mind, the world is found in this fathom-long body. The whole world is found inside of you. Why is that? And the reason is because from a Buddhist point of view, the world that matters is the world of experience. It's the world of experience that really is the only thing that is important. Because that is what we're dealing with. That is where suffering is. That is where happiness is. That is where the problems arise, right? Our experience of the world is what matters. And as far as we know, that could be the only world there is, right? Everything happens within your experience. Nothing can happen outside your experience. So in a very real way, the world actually is the sum of all of your experiences. And because the body really is just an aspect of the world, right? The body also is an aspect of your experience. In fact, the mind is also part of your experience. Everything is really experience. Everything comes within experience, essentially. And whether there is a world out there or not, you know, some people talk about idealism where everything is in the mind. Other people say actually there is an objective world out there. It's kind of irrelevant because from a Buddhist point of view, what we are dealing with is the world of experience. That is what matters. When we talk about the five khandhas, the five aggregates of existence, we're talking about the world of experience. When we're talking about the six senses, we're talking about the world of experience. That is the world that matters. That is where happiness and suffering is found. That is where everything that has anything to do with us is found. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, could you please kindly explain how volitional formations are a condition for consciousness and how clinging is a condition for existence with metta? I can do, but I intend to do this in great detail later on because this is kind of part of the whole. Today, remember, it was just really a short explanation of dependent arising. I intend to look at each of these steps in much more detail as we go along. Let me just put that to the side for now. Maybe I can say something briefly afterwards if we have some more time. But let's just put it there for now. Okay. Dear Ajahn, where and in what context? The Buddha talks about patience in the suttas. Thank you, Angara. Where does he talk about patience? Well, he talks about, you know, kanti, paramang, tittika, how does it go again? I forget how it goes now. Kanti, paramang, tittika, tap, paramang. Anyway, so that's from the Dhammapada, right? That patience is the highest austerity or something like that. Apart from that, where does it talk about patience in the suttas? Patience, one of the words for patience in the sutta is kamo. Kamo means like you are enduring things. It means to endure. It means to be patient, right? When you sit here on this retreat, right, you have 8 days. Actually, the 8 days go really fast. Don't think that the 8 days are long. Sometimes it feels like things are stretching out and it starts to seem long. But before you know it, it will all be gone. It will all be over. But if you start to feel that it feels long and it feels boring or whatever, that's where patience comes in. Right? And this basically means, in Buddhism, it means the ability to bear with things, to be able to endure whatever is happening. If you feel bored, just stay with the boredom. That is patience. If you have no displeasure, you don't feel, you know, uptight or tense or anything like that. You don't have too much pain in the body and all these kind of things. That's already good. But sometimes you feel bored when that happens because you're used to kind of satisfying and gratifying yourself with all kind of entertainment, and your telephone is always there kind of next to you, right, and all these kind of things. So because of this, we are used to so much stimulation in the world, especially these days, right, when the kind of constant flow of information always coming to us. If we had lived 200 years ago, things would have been very different. Because of that, sometimes it can feel boring to live a life like this. But if you stay with that, if you're willing to kind of bear with it, when you come out on the other side, you will start to get into these amazing states that the Buddhist practice can get you to. So that is one aspect of patience, and that is actually explained in the suttas, to have that sense of being able to bear with things. And sometimes there are pains in life which you have to bear, right? Things that you have to bear, the kind of the ill-spoken words of others, when other people say things you don't want to hear. How often does that happen? It happens pretty much every day, except perhaps when you come here. When you come here and nobody talks, you're not going to hear so many bad words. But which is one of the benefits of not talking, of course. But it happens, right? And sometimes it's not even because the other person is bad. It's because we misunderstand, or because we are conditioned differently, or our perception is different. Sometimes we just don't communicate very well. There's all these reasons why we hear these words. But in the end, what it means is that sometimes we have to bear with these things. Okay, the world is full of ill-spoken words. So what am I going to do? I'm just going to have to deal with it, right? It's no point in getting angry and upset because it's always going to be like that. I'm not going to be able to change things anyway. I just have to accept it. And then you come back to this feeling. How am I able to accept these things? Well, basically by understanding that these people are not saying these things because they want to hurt me. That's why we normally get angry, right? They want to hurt me. It's about me. It's personal. That's why we get angry and upset. It's not personal. It is never personal. It's about them. It's about the other person. They have been conditioned this way. They are saying this because of their own conditioning. Got nothing to do with you. And once you understand that, you can start to forgive. You can start to let go. You can understand that they are the real victim of their conditioning. You are not really the victim. You are making yourself become the victim by thinking in the wrong way. But actually, you're not really the victim at all. They are the victim. So by reflecting on these things in the right way, wow, you can become patient. You can bear with these things. You can learn how to deal with these things. Now this is found, one place, one sutta where this is found is in Majjhima Nikaya number 2. The Sambhasava Sutta is called All the Taints, I think, is the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. It has a section on how to endure things, how to bear with things. Other things that you have to bear with is, pains in the body sometimes. Sometimes you can't get away from the pains in the body, right? If you get sick or, you have some chronic ailment or problem or whatever, whatever it is, sometimes you can't get away. You just have to bear with it. You have to accept it. There's no choice in the matter. So you learn to do that. Okay. Dear Ajahn, just a little suggestion, okay? If you don't mind, could you please gently and slowly ring the bell three times? The way you rang the bell, I felt a little discomfort to come out from meditation. Okay. Yeah, this bell is not the best of bells. This doesn't have a really kind of nice ringing sound. It's not very impressive bell, right? You have to say. We should be able to get a better bell on this, I think, for our fancy meditation center. Yeah. Oh well. Okay, I will try my best. I promise. I will try. I cannot, but it's very hard sometimes. You do your best and you see what happens. So maybe that should be on our list. One of the few things that aren't perfect at Dharma Grove is the bell. So we have to sort that out. Okay. Kindly explain, elaborate on extinguish for the meaning of Nibbana. Thank you. extinguish. Okay. It's a pretty nice word, isn't it? Extinguish. I like extinguish. It's really nice. Because one of the reasons why this word is used, the idea, the simile in the suttas for Nibbana is often the simile of the fire going out. In the same way as a fire going out, we let things go out. The main thing that goes out inside of us are the defilements. The defilements are usually classified in the suttas according to a threefold defilement, in many different ways, but one of the main ones is as desire, lobha, ill will, dosa, and moha, delusion, right? Desire, ill will, and delusion. Often translated as greed, hatred, and delusion. I prefer desire, ill will, and delusion, or perhaps confusion is the last one, right? And these are fires, and it's very easy to see why. If you get really angry, how do you feel? You feel literally hot, right? You feel hot inside. It's a fire inside of you. It is something unpleasant. It is something actually, it doesn't feel unpleasant very often. And the reason it doesn't feel unpleasant is because we are focusing on the object. So the object is out there and we forget to feel what it actually feels like. But actually, it is this fire, this heat inside of you. And one of the things that you will note is if you get angry about something, very often afterwards you lose your energy in the mind. You feel tired afterwards. You just want to go to sleep. It's like you're exhausting the energy reserves inside of you, and you feel tired as a consequence. So it has many, many bad consequences, anger, for you personally and also for other people, obviously. And the same thing with desire, right? When desires get very strong, when cravings are very powerful, it's like a fire inside of you. It's this fire, it's agitated fire. You can't sit still. You're restless. You're agitated. You're not enjoying your meditation. You're just fantasizing about stuff, right? One of the fantasies people have on retreat is eating in the afternoon. Oh, now is the time for my dinner. Wow, I will be eating all these nice things. And it's difficult for you guys, right? You're not used to this. For me, it's quite easy. I've been a monk for 20 years. I'm used to not eating in the afternoon. But for the rest of you, I feel sorry for you sometimes, right? Oh, now is dinner time. I'm supposed to be eating, right? And this is what happens. So you have to look at the feeling of that. You know you can't satisfy that urge to have dinner anyway. If you can't satisfy it, chuck it out the window. Forget about it. Don't worry about those things. But you will see that when that desire becomes very strong, right? You can just kind of see the shape of the food in your mind, right, and all these kind of things. You can almost taste it, almost, but not quite. And of course, when that desire becomes very strong, it's like a fire inside of you. It burns you. And this is why the Buddha uses this metaphor of extinguishing a fire. But he also talks about old age being a fire, death being a fire, all the sorrows and pains in the life being a fire as well. All that too gets extinguished when you reach Nibbana. That's what Nibbana is about, the extinguishment of all these fires. Of course, the main fire that gets extinguished is suffering itself. Suffering itself gets extinguished, right? Now, if suffering gets extinguished, it's a pretty good deal, right? It's quite handy to get rid of all suffering, and all you have left is happiness. So this is kind of the promise of the Buddhist path. Extinguish all suffering, all you have left is happiness. Wow, this is what this is all about. So very, very powerful and very beautiful. So that is the idea of extinguishment in Buddhism. And ultimately, of course, then when everything is extinguished and you have none of these defilements left to you, eventually the final extinguishment is when you are, if you are a fully enlightened person, right? Very hard to imagine what that means, fully awakened, very difficult to understand. But when the fully awakened person eventually dies, that's the final extinguishment. When you pass in, when you kind of, this final Nibbana happens, and then the final extinguishment, which is the extinguishment of the five khandhas, the physical and psychological aspects of a person, that too gets extinguished. Whoa, then you are even more happy as a consequence. So that is the idea of extinguishing. It's taken from the metaphor of extinguishing a fire. Okay, dear Ajahn, sometimes during meditation I gain consciousness with a sudden jerk of my head. What is happening? Am I falling asleep? If yes, how can I avoid this with metta? Yes, if you are kind of suddenly, a sudden kind of jerk of your head, it's quite likely that you are losing a bit of mindfulness, right? So you're kind of drifting off somewhere, maybe not quite asleep or whatever, but you're obviously not really clear of what's going on. You have lost your mindfulness to a certain degree. There could be that there is some sloth or torpor. Usually if you have sloth or torpor, you feel tired afterwards. It could also be that you're just drifting off into some kind of fantasy realm somewhere, not really having a lot of clarity about what is going on there. But it is, generally speaking, how do we overcome tiredness in meditation practice? And this is a very important issue because it affects a lot of people. Restlessness, right, a lot of thinking is one issue that affects people. Tiredness is the only one. And sometimes you feel tired, and if you don't feel tired, well, then you think instead, right? There's nothing in the middle. Either I think or I'm tired. What is going on here? I can't really find the middle way. And all of these things, restlessness and tiredness, they're all kind of escapes, right? Initially, tiredness, of course, when you come here to Jhana Grove, you come from a busy life outside, then of course you feel tired because your life has been very busy. So you need a bit of time just to allow things to calm down and become peaceful and just to enjoy the atmosphere here. And as you start to enjoy the atmosphere, your mind kind of gets energized, right? You allow the tiredness to go. So first of all, just make sure that you sleep enough, even if you have a snooze during the day or whatever, all that is fine. Just take as much sleep as you think you need. And then that is obviously the first step to overcome these things. And then if you still feel tired after that, and very often the reason for that tiredness is that you want to escape from something, right? You don't really want to be here. It's boring, right? It doesn't really, it's just, oh, what? Why did I come on this retreat? What a massive mistake, right? If you think like that, as soon as you think, oh, this was a big mistake coming on this retreat, you're going to get even more tired, right? Or you're going to get restless, or you're going to fantasize. That is the last thing you should think. If you think that, you've had it, you're finished on this retreat. So instead of thinking that, you should try to energize. Think, wow, actually, it's wonderful to be on this retreat. It's great to be here. You should emphasize the positive state of mind. Because when you get into a positive state of mind, the positivity will energize you, will give you the sense of, actually, wow, what a wonderful opportunity this is to get away from all the ordinary things in life, to be around good people, to have a chance to listen to the word of the Buddha, right? How many people in the world have a chance to listen to this spiritual genius, this marvelous person who lived 2,500 years ago, who gave these teachings that resonate through time, 2,500 years, a very different culture from ancient India, and still they resonate with us to the present day because they actually talk directly to the human condition. They're not bound by culture, not bound to culture, not bound to time, not bound to anything really. They talk directly to the human condition as it is, a kind of universal human condition. Wow, you have this chance, right, to hear these things. These are the things that are going to make you happy, that are going to help you deal with life for years, for decades, perhaps for lifetimes into the future. Right? Wow, what a wonderful opportunity this is. You have a chance, if you feel restless and bored, you have a chance at least to do a few bushwalks around here. There is national forest outside of the boundary of this property, and you can just walk as far as you want. Don't walk too far, because otherwise you might get lost. You might end up in Sydney or something. That would be a bit unfortunate, but there's like endless amount of bush out there. This is kind of the Australian bush. It doesn't stop. It goes a long, long, long way. So do whatever. Just make sure that you enjoy yourself. Drink lots of cup of tea. Lie down on your bed. Read something. It doesn't matter what you do. The most important thing is to have a positive attitude to what is going on here. So if you go a little bit, crazy or restless or whatever, and do whatever it takes to bring you back again. And then, once you get that positive attitude going, then the meditation will start to happen. And one of the powerful lessons here, one of the things that you really should learn from this, the reason why you feel tired because you haven't got enough happiness, It means that your daily life, the ordinary life that you have, that is so important for how you experience meditation on the meditation retreat. If you live your ordinary life well, if you're able to kind of up the game a little bit in your ordinary life, right? Then next time you come on this retreat, you will have less tiredness. Your mind will be more bright. You start to understand how your ordinary life is so incredibly important for your ability to meditate on meditation retreats. These are the things you learn, and when you learn these things in the right way, then you will start to be able to deal with these things. Okay, that was the last question. Let me just, I can maybe answer very briefly this other question that was here. I said I'm going to talk about this in more detail later on. We've got a couple of more minutes before the hour is up. So because repetition is good, can maybe be useful to look at this again. So how do volitional formations, right? How does the will inside of us, this creative force, how is it a condition for consciousness? The way it is a condition for consciousness is that every time you will something, right? Every time you do something, then that action is sometimes it's good, right? You're coming from kindness. Sometimes it's not so good. You're feeling a bit or upset or something, right? Sometimes it's kind of neutral. So it's a spectrum of different actions. But the problem is that when you do these actions, you have to take ownership of them. Right? This is what the sense of self is all about. Sense of self, the idea that I am here, means that it feels to you as if you are responsible for these actions coming from you. So because you are responsible, you have to take ownership, right? If you do something good, that's why you feel good about yourself, because you did it. Hooray! I did a good action. Right? You feel happy about yourself. Or you did a bit bad action. Ooh, I'm not feeling a bit ashamed of yourself, right? Please don't tell anybody else I did this, because I feel a bit bad about having done this. Right? So this is what it means. You have to take ownership. And because you have to take ownership of your good and bad actions, it affects the state of your mind. You do something bad, it drags the mind down. The level of consciousness gets depressed. You do something good, you feel good about yourself. Wow! Your level of consciousness gets elevated. And of course, the accumulation of all these actions, if you do a lot of good and very little bad, the tendency will be upwards, and you start to lift yourself up, you start to soar, right? You get this light and beautiful mind. You do a lot of bad stuff and few good things, the opposite happens. You're dragging yourself down, you're feeling responsible for all the badness. I did all these bad things. You're dragging yourself down, you feel miserable about yourself. So this is how our actions, our will, our doing inside affects our mind very, very profoundly. And when you think about that, you get a bit worried about doing bad things, right? You see how it affects you. So it becomes a very powerful motivation to actually do what is right. Right, I said that dependent arising is supposed to be practical. This is one of the very practical lessons of dependent arising. It affects you. Every act you do affects you. So every act matters. Every act would make a difference for how you feel about yourself and the world around you. So that is how it works. It's not that hard to understand, but I will repeat it again later on when we get to that point. Not sure when that will be, maybe tomorrow or something. And how is clinging a condition for existence? Okay, so I don't really like the translation clinging. I think grasping is much better, or taking up, or holding onto, or something like that is a much better way of the word is upadana in Pali. It literally means to take something up. You grasp onto things. So because we crave things in the world, we want to ensure that our desires are met, so we hold on to all these things, right? All the objects in the world, all the things we own, all the relationships we have, this is where all the clinging, the attachment, the taking up happens. So because we have all these things, we have all these objects in our life that we are attached to, we have all these relationships, all these people that we are attached to, family members, friends, whatever it is, we are attached to these people. We have all these views that we are attached to, right? you know, it said you should never talk about religion in the part at the party, because if you do, you're going to end up in an argument. Why? Because people have views. Don't talk too much about politics, right? If you talk about politics, you're going to end up having an argument with somebody. Why? Because we attach to the views. That's why there is a problem there. So all of these things are things that we have taken on board, which are part of our identity. And because we have taken these on board, you will notice in your mind that your mind tends to revolve around those things. And that revolving of the mind around those things means that you exist in that way, right? Remember, existence is your personal experience of reality. So when your mind revolves around these pleasures, these attachments, you think about those things, it means that that is how you are existing. Right? So you exist, you live, your very nature, your habits, everything about you revolves around where you have attachments, where you have taken things up, the things in the world that are important to you. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And if it doesn't, I will try to go through it again at a later stage. And if you don't get it then, don't worry too much about it, because in the end, what really matters on this path is how we practice. So as long as you're able to practice in the right way, that is the most important thing here. Okay, so that is all for this evening. So I will see you again, if you wish, at tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. And if not, I'll see you at 8 o'clock for the next installment of this exciting retreat of the Word of the Buddha. And now, just to finish off, let's do the Homage to the Triple Gem, the Arahant Sammasambuddha.